The wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Ian Winterton, and with me today, in The Bunker, is Joe Lidster, writer of Big Finish audios, lots of television, stage plays, all manner of things.
Hello, Joe.
Hi.
Good to see you again. You're in the post-apocalyptic bunker with only 5 Doctor Who stories, which is a really good way of us not getting sued by the BBC, because it's not a desert island. But also it's a really good way of sort of focusing people's minds on, if you really, we all love Doctor Who, that's the one thing everyone in this has got in common. If you really could only have 5 Doctor Who stories, what would you, which ones would you pick? So you've given me them already in advance, and I've sort of put them in an order. I'm thinking the 5 Doctors is first. Is that, you were 6 when that came out. Is that very early? Right. Is that very early you watching Doctor Who?
No, how did you? I have no memory of it at all.
Oh, you don't?
Well, I have a terrible memory generally, but especially of my childhood. No, that's one of the later ones, is my first proper memory.
Oh, I see. So is Terror of the Vervoids, yeah, sort of your first, I remember, yes, this on TV? So let's talk about Terror of the Vervoids then, because I've just spent the morning watching it for the first time, I think, since Transmission, because I'm a bit older than you. So I remember going, so who's going a bit off the boil? And you were like, this is amazing, because I'm 10. It's actually really good watching it again. There's lots of brilliant stuff in Terror of the Vervoids. What are your memories of it, and how has it changed throughout your life? But what's your first memory of Vervoids?
So I have 2 very clear memories. So before this, I have a vague memory of the Doctor and Peri running in the mysterious planet through a forest, and I saw a picture of the Malice when I was in my early teens, and that came back to me. So I do vaguely, I don't remember seeing the Malice, but seeing the picture of it made me remember it, and I remember being terrified by it. Terror of the Vervoids, I remember 2 clear things about it. One was that when the Doctor pauses the footage, and, you know, sometimes it's, well, if you'd all been watching properly, you'd all know who the person who's going to die was. And all this stuff, which I actually think is quite fun. Pip and Jane, I do think, are using the trial setup to actually have a bit of fun and go, something bad's about to happen if you've been paying attention. Because it is like they're talking to us at home. Mm-hmm. And my mum worked it out. My mum spotted it. I have this clear memory of me, my brother, and my sister sat on sofa, and my mum, I think she was ironing. She was going out. I know she was going to work that evening. And I just have this clear memory of she'd worked it out, because she's a big Agatha Christie fan. Mm-hmm. So she'd worked out that one of the Megarians did impress his translating thing. And I just remember being, A, super impressed with my mum, because she was as clever as Doctor Who. It was like, it engaged me. It absolutely engaged me that, I don't know, that I'm not a particularly erudite person, but it's that kind of thing of going, it kind of made me go, oh, there's a story here. It's not just things happening. There's stuff to work out. There's a mystery and all that stuff. And then I became a realist as well. Mm-hmm. So it probably influenced that. And then my second clear memory of it is the one of the Vervoids shakes hands with the bad guy, Lasky's assistant, and he leaves a thing in it, a spike, whatever it is. And that scared the hell out of me. I wouldn't shake anyone's hand for ages. I was totally freaked out by it. Because I think, again, maybe just that thing that, you know, Pip and Jane, bonkers as they are, but one thing, again, that did was it engaged me, because you got, the man knew he was going to die. Up until then, I think people in Doctor Who got shot or exterminated or blown up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was like, boom, they're gone. Whereas this was a man, I just remember him looking at it and the realisation on his face of knowing he's going to die.
Mm.
And I just found that terrifying. Bring that in a good way, though. It was good, scary.
Well, but, that's I think that's the thing with Doctor Who. Every one of us that loves it remembers with glee being scared and that fire in our imagination. Whereas other people maybe go, that scared me. Why would I want to do that?
And also the bit with the lady who's been half
turned. Yeah.
They open a thing and she's there. And that was, again, that was just like, oh my God, what's going on?
That body horror, it's weird because I've just had to rewatch Alien 4 for another podcast. And it's weird because in Alien 4 they have the Sigourney Weaver mutant clone. And it was weird seeing the same moment in Doctor Who and going, obviously, the Doctor Who came first. But it was like, oh God, that is horrible. I hadn't remembered it at all. I mean, that's the thing with watching things on TV. Maybe I came in late for that or just looked down or something and you miss it forever, don't you? I love all the stuff you do miss when you were a kid, or you didn't because of your mum, but you know that it's an Agatha Christie in space, Honor Blackman's reading, Murder on the Orient Express, and all these amazingly cool little things. It's weird because it's this one that's kind of become infamous because of Chibnall slagging it off as a teenager, isn't it? It was this one. It's the Vervoid. Yeah.
Understand that. Because I'm slightly younger than Chris, loved it, and I loved the look of it. Because does it look like some kind of huge luxury space liner? No, but the main hall bit with the garden furniture and stuff looks like nothing else on TV. It looks more like Howard's Way in space than anything else. Yeah. But also, like, we didn't go on many family holidays when I was a kid. We were poor, poor northerners. And what we did do occasionally was go to North Sea Ferry, because North Sea Ferry would go from Hull, which is near us, so we'd go on school trips, we'd go to Germany. We'd also do a couple of times with my family. And things like, when is it Mel's exploring one of the cabins?
Mm.
And the Vervoid comes in, she hides in the shower. And it's this tiny little cabin. And I thought that was brilliant, because that was just like the cabins on the North Sea Ferry, because they were so small. And literally a bed and a door, you know. And it was like, again, just little things like that, that actually, because Chris was older as a teenager, was he a teenager, wasn't he? Looking at was going, these are cheap sets. Because I was still young enough, I was looking at it going, this is like a North Sea Ferry.
Yeah.
And really cool, because it's like, oh my God, what if a monster? It's why, I mean, I will always defend to my death the opening of Battlefield, because people go, you know, oh, it should be a more exciting opening. And I'm like, after years of adventures in things like Terror of the Vervoid, we started this. I remember sitting with my family, we put Doctor Who on while we were eating our tea, and there was some old bloke potting around in the garden centre. And it was like, we had to go to garden centres nearly every Sunday, because my parents were into garden, and it was like, oh my God, a Doctor Who story set in my world, set in, you know, centre, imagine, you know. And so it's actually going, at that point, I'm young enough to be engaged by it. I've not reached the embarrassing teenage bit where I'm embarrassed by it. The Doctor Who finished when I reached my angry teenage years, and I read the angry teenage Doctor Who books that were grown up.
Yeah. We'll come on to those later when we're discussing your own journey into being a Doctor Who writer.
I think Terror of the Vervoids has some really genuinely brilliant stuff in it. The end of episode one is amazing. One of the best cliffhangers in Doctor Who.
It really...
The Vervoids are genuinely terrifying when you're six. You know, but then when you get older, you're like, oh no. And there's a lot of characters in it. And I loved Janet. I was strange to Janet, normal compared to everybody else. You know, it's a normal person.
As a writer watching it this morning, I was going, this moves along at a clip. What's everyone moaning about? It moves along at a clip. It's a really well constructed four episode.
It's proper.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the dead bodies piled up like the compost heap or whatever. It's probably sick.
And it ends with the word genocide.
That's what I was going to do there,
right? Yeah, and the final word of it is Michael Jayston shouting genocide. So it's I do have a lot of problems with the whole Trial of the Time Lord bits. But I think you're right that they actually, at least, it doesn't feel like Eric Saward's just inserting them wearily to an existing script. It at least feels like, whether it's him or Pip and Jane Baker, they've actually done something with that format.
Yeah.
Although I don't... Do you know why it's set in the Doctor's future and the Doctor's able to watch it?
No idea. Makes any sense, does it?
No, that was something I was previously unaware of. I was going, oh yeah, and then they never actually made Mel meeting the Doctor. I think that had to happen in a not on screen, because Colin left, and I think they've done it in the new adventures. and various and things. It's really not my area. And Big Finish, it's probably been done about four times.
Yeah.
Same as Ace's Death and things like that. So when did you last watch Terror of the Vervoids? Did you watch it as a comfort one? Like, is it one of your comfort eps? Do you stick it on for people that have never seen it?
I don't really have comfort eps. I'm really bad. So what I do tend to do is watch the Blu-rays. We get the Blu-ray and they come out. So I tend to watch everything then that's on the Blu-ray. Maybe sound really snobbish or whatever. There's just lots of new stuff I like watching. I like watching new stuff on Netflix. Terror of the Vervoids, I did rewatch probably 5, 6, 7 years ago. A bunch of gays, we all got together one afternoon and watched it. And it was brilliant. We got very drunk. And it was absolutely glorious.
That's the way to do it, isn't it?
That's got one of my favourite bad things in it, which is that thing of old TV having to be shot like a theatre. So the cameras are here, everything is in front of the cameras, there's no, the camera can't move in or whatever, unless they do a handheld thing or whatever. And so it's a brilliant bit. I think it's just after the Megarians died. I think it's the Megarian that I was talking about earlier on. He dies, he falls down. And about 46 members of the cast and all stand in one line around his body. And it's brilliant. I took a photo of it. We watched it that time because I just remember finding it so funny. And Bonnie Langford, being the absolute pro that Bonnie Langford is immediately into shot and down into a kneeling position and stuff like that. That's the positions that they've been directed to stand in. Just so bad. But brilliant.
I remember watching it this morning. I was going, I can feel the blocking.
Absolutely. You know, they've been told where to
look for the tape on the floor. No, it's absolutely amazing. It's got such a great cast as well. People you go, it's a classic. I know him from that thing and that thing. Yeah. And he was in, what was he in? Now we can look him up. But I mean, obviously, Michael Tierney, who you mentioned, was really quite well known anyway. But, you know, not just for his getting handshake death with, you know, he was in. I mean, I was a big Lovejoy fan as a kid, and during a period on The Dole when it got repeated, it was literally what I got up for was watching Lovejoy and having my lunch / breakfast.
Ian McShane turning to camera, little wink.
Yeah. I mean, Lovejoy's, but yeah, he played Charlie Gimbert, Lovejoy's nemesis in that. And apparently he was in Brookie, but I've never watched Brookie. And he was in the old Poldark. So he's a proper old hoofer. You strike me as being quite a similar fan to me in that, like you said, you watch Netflix. You don't necessarily rewatch loads of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Unless it's research, I guess, you suddenly have to go and...
Well, I did rewatch one of my other choices. I did watch that yesterday afternoon.
Oh, did you?
Spoiler alert, it's very short.
So, from Terror of the Vervoids, so that was you becoming a Doctor Who fan, which weirdly, well, you probably weren't aware at the time, but was going to be a massive dominating feature of your life and your career.
No.
But it did become, you became a Doctor Who writer quite early on. I guess we'll talk about The Rapture, because I'd never listened to that. I've heard about it, and it's
£2.99. Yeah, I think so. £2.99 too much?
No. I really enjoyed it. It was...
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I'm not just blowing smoke up your proverbial. It was 20 years old. 2002. So, Big Finish is The Rapture. Could you tell me how you became involved in Big Finish? And I'll pretend I don't know.
So, yeah, I did a media degree. I kind of wanted to write. I knew writing was what I wanted to do. I then couldn't work out anywhere. You know, didn't know. I did the media degree, and the one thing it didn't do was study how to get a job. So I wasn't really getting anywhere. I was doing telesales in Newcastle, going out a lot. And then, I knew about Big Finish, but I wasn't listening to them because I couldn't afford them, really. And also, the sign of the times changing, I didn't have a credit, so I couldn't literally... to write a check. If I wanted to buy a Big Finish, I'd have to write a check and post it.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was just all very, so I knew that it would exist, and I just had this idea that I thought would work really nicely on audio of using dance music. I was clubbing a lot at the time. I basically was out most nights.
Were you in Newcastle upon Tyne?
In Newcastle.
Oh well, I lived there in, oh my god, I've just realised I lived there in the same time you were there.
Oh wow.
I was editing the North Guide listings magazine.
Oh.
In 2000 to 2003.
I was doing telesales above a Victoria wine and not living the healthiest of lifestyles.
No, neither was I. A journalist getting invited to these, doing lots of clubbing and getting it for free.
Yeah, brilliant. No, well, then I moved moved to Dublin, and in Dublin, yeah, I worked in car finance. And again, we were out every, you know, I'd literally open my eyes and find myself on the dance floor, and I'd be like, how did we get here? Well, we were having a quiet blink after work. I was ended up in. Yes. So it's very much my lifestyle, but also at the same time, developing mental illness. realizing that I had depression. I got very bad depression at mm-hmm. the time, and I realized I was using the dance music and the going out to help combat that. It took mm-hmm. my mind off everything. Trance music would literally put me in a trance. It's my favorite type of music because it's proper mm-hmm. messes in your head. And I just thought, oh, what if there was a Doctor Who story? But yeah, is there a Doctor Who story in that? What if aliens were taking over the world with dance music? And so I sent an idea to Big Finish. Yeah, Gary Russell wrote back, because it was letters, not the emails. We did eventually move to email. Gary Russell wrote back, eventually commissioned me. And then, yeah, eventually I came over to London they had a Big Finish Christmas party, and that's where I first met everyone. There's Mercedes there, as was Deck Donnelly from Ant and Deck. Yeah, but I was really excited. What really excited me was all the writers were there. So I really became a huge, I have a theory that as a Doctor Who, most people stop wanting to watch Doctor Who at, I don't know, 14, because like you say, it's embarrassing, mm-hmm. it's silly. I'm cool teenager now, I don't want to watch that. Mm-hmm. Except for Doctor Who fans, you go, oh, this is brilliant. And the new event, my Doctor Who fan creed, yeah, were the things that kept me a fan. I haven't read any of it, but you know, I suspect quite a few of them haven't aged. But at the time, as an angsty teenager, they were absolutely what I was looking for. So yeah, I went to the party. Gary Russell said hello to me briefly, then wandered off to talk to somebody else, and I stood there, not a clue what to do. Then Gary came back and said, oh, come over here, I'll sit with these people, these are the writers. And it was like Steve Lyons. I remember just being like, oh my God, it's Steve Lyons. He wrote Head Games and other books that I can't remember the titles of. And he was like, and I got really quite tongue-tied, but it was really good. And yeah, the Rapture, me and Gary had a chat, and he suggested moving to Ibiza, which is great. I've never been, but again, once you do some research, you find out Ibiza's got loads of cool mystical history. And that was it. And then it came out, and I was on Outpost Gallifrey, you know, the sort of Gallifrey-based day. Like, I didn't really post on it. I think I just looked at it from time to time. We didn't even have proper internet, I think, where I was in Dublin. And the trailer came out, and the trailer was so popular because it's an absolutely brilliant trailer, Jim Morton. It's a stunning trailer. It's just a really, really good trailer. It's so funny as well. And then I got sent a copy of the first two episodes, and I listened to them about four times in one morning. I was late for work because I sat outside the office listening. Because I genuinely think episode two of the Rapture is one of the best things I've ever written. To this day, I do think episodes three and four, it all goes off the rails a bit and the story's not great. But I think episode two is genuinely brilliant. Piece of writing, brilliantly edited, amazing edited, the music's stunning. And also at that time for Big Finish, something completely different, which is great. Until it comes out, and people don't necessarily want that. The first review was really popular, was really positive. Oh my God, this is brilliant. Oh, new young writer, woo! Then the second review was, this is one of the worst things ever committed to audio. I mean, one thing they didn't like was Ace Act. Well, I wasn't responsible for that. I was asked to put a brother in, and I thought I'd done a good job of her going, I'm not full of anger, but turns out there was a lot going on. So I immediately stepped back. Because I was going to reply to the first review and say thank you. And then the second review went up, and I was like, oh, but if I reply to the first one and say thank you, what do I reply to the second? Do I not reply? And then I realised, well, actually, you shouldn't be replying at all. You shouldn't be looking. This is what people talk about the drama to. And they can say whatever they like. And actually, I think that possibly saved my career, the Rapture getting bad reviews, because it made me absolutely step back from in any way engaging with reviews or with, just say with fans, because I'm some arsey.
You know which fans you mean.
Stopped engaging with fans online and only engaged them in pubs. I was like, yeah, so I think it actually did me a lot of good because it meant I didn't feel in any way, which I think you can do when you do Doctor Who related stuff, I didn't feel in any way a big fish in a small pond, mm-hmm. which I think you can do. I think you can, because it's crazy. There I was at that point working in car finance in Ireland with a load of people, none of whom knew a thing about Doctor Who. I've got one mate had heard of it and maybe seen some of it. And I was like, I'm just flying back to London to sign autographs this weekend. You know, it's a crazy thing thrown into. And I was only 23, mm-hmm. so I was quite young. And it's a crazy world to be thrown into where suddenly people want your autograph. And you're like, I barely sign checks, you know, let alone autographs. And I think you can become, it's not so much about becoming big-headed, but you become aware that you've become this sort of person. Mm-hmm. That you suddenly you're a bit higher up than other people in some people's estimations and stuff like that. And I think the Rapture going down really bad for a lot of mean, it has its fans, but for a lot of people, it just was all, did actually do me a lot of good, because it meant I kept my focus about that what I wanted to do was be a writer, be a person in the Doctor Who world. It's very exciting having a tiny squeaky page, but that's not my life. My life is writing, not being involved in the world of Doctor Who. And I think that did me a lot of good, because it kept me focused on that. I didn't become too engaged with fandom as a thing. Part of me thinks every writer should get a really bad review at some point, because it forces you to look at your writing. You know, I looked at The Rapture, and actually, you know, I disagreed with the fans who said they didn't want to have stories set in nightclubs, because to me that was the whole point of it. There were a lot of hatred for it because it was like a Tomorrow People story that was broadcast before I was born. I've watched it now, but I hadn't watched it then. I didn't know what they were talking about. But there are major flaws. It made me look at it and go, actually, the ending of The Rapture is really quite rubbish. The ending of episode one is one of the best Doctor Who cliffhangers ever, in my opinion. Episode two is brilliant, and it just goes right off the scales because I wasn't a good enough writer to keep the momentum going and to make it get bigger and bigger, which is, people remember the ending, they don't remember the beginning. So it did me a lot of good, I think. But I still love it.
Honestly, listening to it just a day or so ago, I was, because I'm just writing for Big Finish at the moment, and it's so weird. Oh. Yeah, with Rob Valentine. But it's weird because in one of my outlines, I kind of made reference to an alien, a really non-human alien, smoking some substance, and Rob was like, oh no, you need to take that out. Just to preempt the BBC. And it kind of, and then listening to yours, I was like, it's got bastard and Jesus in it, and people basically coming up on ecstasy.
Yeah, no, well that was it.
And it made me go, it really give me that, because I'm like you, I'm a Virgin New Adventures kid.
That for me was what surprised me, was when people said it's too experimental, it's too weird, it's too modern or whatever. Nothing compared to that. So I was very sort of like, if there was one thing I wasn't liking Big Finish at the time, was stories would start with endless TARDIS scenes. No, I love a scene as a kid, you know, watching them on telly. It's always exciting to see the TARDIS, especially girls growing up with Sylvester and Colin. You didn't late Colin and then or Sylvester. You barely saw the TARDIS, so it was always exciting when you did. But like an audio, I'd get so confused when a Big Finish would start with, well, Doctor, where are we going now? Well, are we going to try and get to this place? And my mic get knocked off, God, and these two people, and I'd be like, it's a modern day drama, but why are you laughing about
it? Because those TARDIS scenes are the scenes when you rewatch Who, you go, I can't believe they didn't cut to the chase. Have them land.
Well, that's it.
Have them land and get out. What the fuck's going on with all this? And then not only that, they're in the TARDIS, then you cut to something happening on an alien planet, then you cut back to the TARDIS, and they're still not getting out of it.
Get on with it. Johnny Morris, I think it's Johnny, loves the line of, and before you ask, the year is 1997. But again, I'm actually quite proud of that, because I'm like, it slightly alters the dynamic of what happens. Normally, the Doctor or the Companion have to go, what year is it? Or find a newspaper or whatever. And I thought it was quite a nice reveal that this guy knew about the Doctor being a time traveller. So he just went, before you ask, the year's 1997.
No. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It was... Yeah.
I won't do spoilers, but I really enjoyed it, honestly. Maybe it's also because I have done my share of dancing in altered states to a repetitive beat. Who did the music for it? Because that's cracking as well. The sort of remix of the Doctor Who theme and the music that's in the episode.
Jim Mortimer,
right? Yeah, it's interesting looking back at Big Finish, like how it. When did they start? 90s, late 90s.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, and that early stage, how brilliant they are. Like when you listen to those, you know, and I've listened to so many thousands of hours of Big Finish. From what you were saying before, you didn't attend the recording or anything.
Oh, no, I did. Yeah.
I was going to say so. I was going to say so because my understanding is they usually have the writer there. That's the more usual thing with audio, isn't it?
No, because again, that was possibly good for the ego. My friend Robert Dick, who sort of does Doctor Who fandom and stuff, Mythmakers interviews and stuff. He took me in, and Sylvester was there, and he introduced me in the corridor, and he introduced me to Sylvester and said, this is Joe, he's written this script, the script you're doing today. And Sylvester went, oh, I assumed it was by Mike Tucker, because it mentioned the grill. And you know, you're like, this is the absolute highlight of my life. This is literally, I'm never going to do anything else. This is the biggest career thing. Not only have I written something, I've been paid to write something. I've written Doctor Who, and it's Doctor Who, and this is, and the main star hasn't read my name on the script. And again, I think that's probably very good for the ego to kind of go, yeah, it might be the most important day in your life. It's not for everybody else. Well, that recording was great fun. Yeah,
it's weird. I met when I was in LA at Gallifrey One. Me and Gareth from Cutaway, we got talking to Sylvester at the bar for ages, and whenever we mentioned, oh, this is based on so and so, he just went, is that a writer? Oh, I never bother with who the writers are.
Yeah.
And as soon as we started talking about his theatre career, or yes, Peter Jackson, yeah, he was away, but mentioning individual writers,
that wasn't
there's
so many.
Yeah, he wasn't there. He wasn't bothered who'd written a script at all. Yeah. It's like he didn't even recognise the name. But anyway, great guy though. Great guy. So that must have been, I mean, Jesus, what, you were 23? A Doctor Who fan at 23 in studio with Sylvester 20, McCoy.
No, 24.
24, yeah.
24, I think. Because it's 20 years ago and I've just turned 45. Yeah, no, really exciting. I didn't really speak to anyone. I was nervous. I was excited.
No one needed any lines changing or anything.
I don't remember anything like that. It was Jason Hay-Gallery's first direction.
Yeah,
as well. So it was a big first for everybody. No, it was fun. And we recorded. I went behind the microphone, so I was one of the clubbers. But also remember, we recorded. I think there were zombies or something for Plague Herds of Excellus. We were people chasing Benny or Iris.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Benny and Iris, isn't it? We were chasing one of them, and it was us going down with her or off with her head, that kind of thing. And that was just really exciting. That was really fun. It was like, oh my God, I'm going to be in Doctor Who now. like you can hear me. I'm in a crowd. But it was so exciting. And then when the cover got released, and it was gorgeous, it's beautiful, like clay. I was very, very. It was very, very exciting. I didn't know whether to put on the list, and I thought, well, actually, it's where my whole writing career started. I owe Big Finish so much. I think it was me and Phil Pasco. We were the two absolute new writers they took on, and they really did take a chance on us. We both did experimental stories, and yeah, I was just so grateful that they took that chance.
Yeah, with the mighty Gary Russell.
Yeah,
really is.
But I think one thing Gary was always very good at was that Gary, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, and I say Gary's not a fan of the new adventure, but he recognised that Doctor Who is so many different styles, and so and the Big Finish should be that. Big Finish shouldn't be his vision of Doctor Who. He wasn't producing ongoing stuff. He was producing things. So he should employ someone like me who was doing it, approaching it from Virgin New Adventures and just generally a younger TV film media mindset. You know, I wasn't writing it from sort of, you know, having watched Tom Baker a lot. It was from a very different point of view. And I think Gary was very good at employing different types of writers and doing different types of stories.
Yeah, well, that's a great skill as a producer. This isn't necessarily for me. It's for the wider listenership/readership, whatever. And yeah, I mean, Gary's. Hopefully, we'll be interviewing Gary for this. I keep having to pinch myself that I'm editing him in the comic strips. He's the Inferno spin-off that he's doing for Cutaway. Yes.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga. Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin. Written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic. Written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
So on to your, I'd say, should we talk about the Five Doctors then quickly before we move on to your your sort of if we sort of talk about Edge of Destruction and the Five Doctors, who are your two choices you didn't write? Before we end with your end with another one that you did write.
So that you didn't bother writing.
Yeah. So was Edge of Destruction the one you rewatched?
Yesterday. So I chose Edge of Destruction because when I was a kid, the way I got into Doctor Who more was through the books. So our library had a lot of Peter Davison hardbacks, and I played them out. And being young, I didn't really make the connection that the Peter Davison hardback, these books were necessarily the same as the TV show I was watching with, you know, the Doctor and Mel or the Doctor and Ace in. It was like, I thought there were different things. I just didn't really make the connection. Anyway, we had this school bookshop where you could, you know, get a load of books in. You could buy books. You pay 20p each week or each day. I pay 20p, you know, all this stuff, and buy a book. And one day she had Dragonfire on the thing, on the book of Dragonfire. And I was like, I've seen that on telly. And it sort of all clicked. And suddenly I was like, hey, this whole history of this TV show. And she introduced me to another boy at school, my mate Chris, I still mention him, Chris Taylor, who was a big, big Doctor Who fan, hexed on his back. And through him, I got to really sort of start to see how there was all this Doctor Who. So through him, I kind of got to see the Five Doctors, and because we started renting, he had the videos. And I was so excited about seeing the Five Doctors because just so exciting. But also separately to him, I really got into the Target novelizations in a big way. And I remember particularly, I really, really adored the early Hartnell ones, the sort of John Peel, Dial Master Plan, things like that. They are amazing books. And The Edge of Destruction was an amazing book. It was so exciting to read that for the first time and be like, Doctor Who suddenly became this huge mythical thing, because like the way it describes the TARDIS is so different to what, you know, it's like these huge rooms and everything like that. And who are they? You know, just, I became obsessed with Ian and Barbara. And the Doctor just being not right. And so both of those two things, the Five Doctors and the Edge of Destruction, actually have the similar thing of, they both really helped make me a Doctor Who fan, because I've then, obviously since then, and as I did yesterday, watched the TV version of Edge of Destruction, and I think it's brilliant. I think it is two absolutely stunning 25 minutes pieces of television. And I actually think for all the, you know, people go, oh, the new series, you know, really, well, I mean, the new series obviously ups the emotional reality of things. I brought in families and stuff. But the last 5 minutes of Edge of Destruction are absolutely beautiful. And the fact that it's Barbara, not Ian, that the Doctor has to, is so, you know, it's something ahead of its time. And it's just brilliant that Doctor and Barbara becoming friends, and genuinely get a heart, you know, lump in my mouth when watching it yesterday. And I was like, because Jacqueline Hill and William Hartnell and William Russell and Carolyn Ford, because they're all so good. It's like, I'm really quite moved when Barbara takes the Doctor's arm and you go, oh, they are going to be friends. This is all going to work out well. Stunning. And I do think it's a really fun 225 episodes. But yes, it was the book. Really, those Hartnell novels, novelizations, and then the Charlton ones as well. They were, I was like, I don't know who Ben and Polly are, but I'm so excited whenever I read about them. You know, I didn't know who any of these people were. It was so exciting because obviously this is the time before the internet. Now, if you become a Doctor Who fan, you click on Doctor Who, you type Doctor Who into Google, and you've got the whole history of it there. In those days, because the internet didn't exist, you discovered it. So it would be things like, there were those bizarre novels where they brought out two Doctor Who novelizations in one book. They did about six or seven of them. And obviously I got those because then I'd get two stories and I'd find one. And we had a list of, I managed to get a list from the BBC of all the Doctor Who stories in order. And like my mum especially, she, every time she was in a second-hand bookshop, she's like, Joe, they've got Doctor Who books, come here. There was a shop in Brighton called Burton's Bookshop. Don't know if it's still there. And we used to go there because we had family in Brighton, so we used to go on holiday there quite a bit. Every time we go to Brighton, we go straight to Burton's Bookshop, straight there, got my list out. What have I got? What haven't I got? Whatever. So the books were so important. One of those glorious memories of my childhood is me and my mum together in Burton's Bookshop, going to it, her holding the list, me looking through the books. Because there were so many, because, you know, when you're a kid, there's like thousands of these Doctor Who TV stories in the past, with Katarina and Adric, whoever these people are. And so with the books, it was always like, have you got the moon bit? I don't know what it says. Tomb of Cybermen. I don't know if I got that one. Because you didn't know what Tomb of Cybermen was. You just knew it was a title. Brilliant. And yeah, so, and then at the same time, through Chris, got into like the videos that had been released. So he had all the VHSs, and obviously So he'd be like, what are we going to watch? I'm not very high-pitched voices, but, you know, what do you want to watch now? And I was like, I don't know. Because, again, it was that thing of going, because we were kids, you couldn't stay up all night. Now, if I become a fan of something, like I watched Mulholland Drive for the first time. I went to the cinema and watched Mulholland Drive last week. And I instantly came home, put on my Amazon wish list. I want the DVD, the CD, and a poster of it. And I'm getting all, like, two of them, the other one's coming, all for my birthday within, you know, within a week. That's how the world is. You could become a fan and instantly get it all. If I was getting into Doctor Who now, if I suddenly watched Doctor Who and fell in love with it now, I wouldn't go to sleep for the next week. I'd stay up all night. Well, actually, I'm 45 now. I have to go to sleep. But I would stay up late and watch it, or get up early and watch it. When you were a kid, you know, in those days, it was like we could watch, whenever I went to Chris's, we could watch one Doctor Who story. And so I'd have to choose which one. Anyway, so obviously, quite early on, I chose the Five Doctors. Because it was like, I have never seen any of these Doctors. I think at that point, I hadn't seen any of them in anything, or any of the companions. So it would be my first experience of Jamie, Zoe, and Liz Shaw. And I was obsessed with the fact that she was always Liz Shaw, but she wasn't called Liz. Everybody else was just their first name, so she was always Liz Shaw, and she's in The Five Doctors. And yeah, and I obviously fell in love with it, because The Five Doctor, I mean, it's the... There are Doctor Who stories I still haven't seen. There's John Pertwee's and Tom Baker's I still haven't seen. The Five Doctors, if you put us on now, I could say every line along with it and sing the incidental music. I know it back to front. I know exactly every intonation of every line. It's got one of my favourite lines ever in Doctor Who. Two of my favourite lines ever in Doctor Who. One is Tegan saying, it's an entry coder. Why would you say that? Why would you not say... Do you think, is that got that problem? 80s Doctor Who thing, people just not talking like real human beings. So it's an entry coder. I'm pretty certain, I think Johnny Morris again has done a story set just before The Five Doctors where Tegan is taught what an entry coder. But it's also got my favourite thing, which is not the mind probe. My favourite thing is the sort of, Governor Guard, when he kills the Castellan, and you know, he goes, well, as you can see, he was armed and trying to escape. Because everybody else had gone for it, except for Anthony Potts, and they got very slowly. Well, as you know, the Constitution clearly states.
They got some
like that, and then there's this guy who's like, as you can see, he was on trying to escape. Not my fault.
He's some Shabogan who's smuggled himself in.
So the Five Doctors will always be special because it was my first time seeing the first, second, third, fourth, fifth Doctors and all those companions. There's a book that's about the behind the scenes of the Visitation. Mm-hmm. It's something like Doctor Who, a producer's diary or something. And it's got brief history of Doctor Who, but it's also got bits of Bob Teague and this one, Aldrich, who I must have seen somewhere growing up, but I had no memory of them. I used to love getting this book out from the library. It was one of the reasons I really wanted to get into television, because I was so bizarrely obsessed with the fact that they hung fake ivy to hide wires. They just do, obviously, to hide things. And I was just like, this is amazing. They just, every time I watch anything on telly now, let's say in the past, I'm going to be looking out for fake ivy going, oh, there's a telephone wire behind there. So what I was really bizarrely thinking was when I watched The Five Doctors, and Tegan doesn't look like she does look in the behind the scenes of the Visitation book. Because obviously Tegan has such a makeover when she leads in Time Flight. So it's a completely different hair, completely different look. And it's like she goes from being a 70s character to an 80s character just off screen. And I do remember being very surprised watching The Five Doctors going, why doesn't Tegan look like she does in this behind the scenes?
It's competition time. Up for grabs this episode is a CD and download of our audio adaptation of our Omega comic books. Written by Mark Griffiths, the full cast drama stars the mighty Brian Blessed as the eponymous renegade. Winners will also receive a copy of Omega Unplugged, Mark Griffiths' comic book story collected into one volume, with John Ridgway's wonderful art rendered in black and white, bringing to mind his work back in the 1980s on Doctor Who magazine's Doctor Who strip. Being with a chance to win, simply answer this question. The character of Omega first appeared in the TV story The Three Doctors. Which actor portrayed him? Send us your answers via Twitter messaging or via email to cutawaycomics@gmail.com before the launch of our next episode, and you'll be in with a chance to win. Due to postage costs, physical prizes are only available to UK residents. If you win and are outside the UK, we'll send you digital versions of the comics and the audio instead. Good luck.
I guess that brings us on to your final choice, which is the Mad Woman in the Attic two-parter, What You Wrote, for Sarah Jane. Now, how did you, before we get into it, how did go from your first big finish to writing, as we now know. You wrote Sarah Jane, you wrote Torchwood, you've written many other things all over the place. But was Sarah Jane your first TV?
No, Torchwood. There were two things happened at the same time. The first series of Doctor Who, the new version, point I'd moved to London. I was living in London just because I was doing a lot of Big Finish. I was doing a lot of all their ranges. I really enjoyed doing it. It was great, actually, because I mean, I had to watch like all of Sapphire and Steel, which I'd never seen. Gary Russell kind of was getting me to do things like, so when Torchwood was announced, I did abridge the original three novels.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on set with the writers of the three novels. Gary was very keen that the writers came on set and that I came on set, as because I was going to abridge the books, and he felt, you know, I should know what Gwen's flat looks like and things like that, which was great. And then around that same time, James Goss, who I don't think I knew particularly well at the time, I think we knew each other, but he came up to me at the Fitzroy Tavern, the famous pub where all the Doctor Who fans meet,
mm-hmm.
and he'd listened to my unit story, The Longest Night. And he just said, I just wanted to say, I listened to it last night and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really great. And I was a bit drunk and I went, and at that point, James was in BBC Wales because he was doing websites. So he was doing, he did the websites, a series on a doctor. I turned around to him a bit drunkenly and went, if you think I'm that good, employ me on your websites. And he went, well, that's actually why I came to talk to you. And I went, oh, okay. Yeah, so he, on series two of Doctor Who, the Christmas Invasion was my first story that I did the websites for. So I did the British space programme, was a bug for that man who gets killed and things like that. It was so exciting. It was like, because I got to see the script beforehand and so on. It also kind of meant I was going to Cardiff quite a bit. So between James and Gary doing the different things, I was kind of getting known because I was quite young. I loved going out. You know, I'd go out with people. So I'd hung out a lot with sort of like the Doctor Who confidential people because they were a much younger team. And I just kind of got a little bit known there. And also what it meant, everything I did, every website, every TV tie-in, every tie-in audio, whatever, everything was read and approved by Russell. So I was basically script edited by Russell T. Davis. And then Torchwood Series 1 came out, and then Torchwood Series 2 was going into pre-production. And Russell said to Gary Russell, if there was any writer from Big Finish you think we could give a chance to on Torchwood, who would it be? You know, because I think he thought it was going on to BBC Two, wasn't it, at that point? It'd done BBC Three, but because it wasn't Doctor Who the main show,
mm-hmm.
you could take a punt on an untested, well, a writer who'd done stuff but hadn't done telly before. You could give somebody a break in television.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary very nicely said me. And I then had a meeting with Russell and Julie, neither of whom I'd met before, and I think I wore a suit. If I remember right, I think I probably wore a suit. And very lucky was I was a huge fan of Series 1 of Torchwood, which, again, a bit like The Rapture, it had a lot of haters because people were like, this isn't what we expect from Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, but it's not Doctor Who, it's a series, it's a BBC Three spin-off. It's targeted at the BBC Three audience. So you absolutely do 100% have a sex cast alien monster in episode two. You absolutely do that. And then what you do is you do the Russell T. Davis show thing, which is halfway through the episode, when you've had all the titillation and fun and silliness, halfway through the episode, somebody, a character points out, going, this is a real person. So I'd absolutely adored Series 1 of Torchwood, except for the episode by PJ Hammond, who is the creator of Sapphire and Steel, which is my one of my favourite TV shows. So it's not slight on him at all that I didn't particularly enjoy his episode in Series 1 of Torchwood. I didn't think it really fitted with Torchwood. So it meant that when Russell said, what do you think of Series 1? I was able to be honest and mm-hmm. really rave about it and say I loved everything about it. But also, I was able to be honest and say, but there was one episode I wasn't a big fan of. So I think he knew
mm-hmm.
I was absolutely 100% being truthful and honest. And yes, so I was very lucky. I was then commissioned to write what they call an over commission, which is where they'd commission 15 scripts for the 13 episode series, so that if any episode fell through, me and whoever the over commission was, we'd be there available to replace them. And then, I don't know the ins and outs. I don't know what scripts fell through. I just knew what I was writing. And I was at a party at Gary Russell's house, and 42. We watched 42, a whole bunch of and I remember not too confidential people there. We all watched episode 42 as it went out. And then as we were talking, I think it was Helen Rayner said something to me. And I was like, she knew more about my Torchwood script than I expected. and then Gillian Seaborn, who was the producer of Doctor Who Confidential, she said something. And again, I was like, this is a bit odd. And I sort of went to Gary and I said, is my overcommission a commission now? And Gary went, yes. I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want to freak you out while you're writing the script, but yes, you're writing an episode of Sir Thorfinn, at which point I properly freaked out. And had to be taken out of the party and sat on the stairs, the communal stairs, was flat apartment block. Had to sit there and sort of basically hyperventilated. So yes, I was very lucky. He did talk through it, which was amazing, an amazing experience. Obviously, you know, just I'm writing television, this is amazing, and it turns out it's still one of my favourite shows. And then Russell immediately employed me then on Sarah Jane a bit, and I did 3 years on that. Yeah, did three stories on that. And my middle story is The Madwoman in the Attic, and I chose that because I think it's one of the best things I've written, personally. It's not the one people remember. People remember more Clyde's dad and Berserker Pendant and stuff, or a lot of people do remember The Nightmare Man. But yeah, I do think, I think The Madwoman in the Attic is, but I'm very proud of the script, but I just think it's a beautiful piece of television.
Yeah.
It's so well directed by Alice Troughton.
Yeah, no relation, Alice Troughton, as we would say.
Yeah, it's a it's gorgeous what she does. I mean, I know I specified a lot in it about mirrors, people looking into mirrors, because I'm always slightly obsessed with the whole mirror thing, and actually if you have an old character and a young version of the same character, they're both looking into mirrors. You know, I don't know why. I just find that stuff interesting. So I know I'd specified that, but she's shot it so beautifully. And the actress playing old Rani is amazing. She's absolutely 100% convincing.
Suad Fares.
Yes.
She's in, just doing my research for this, she's had a career all the way from I, Claudius and Blake Seven.
Yeah.
And she's in Dune, the recent Dune.
The new one.
And she's and she's in The Sandman on Netflix.
Blimey.
So she's, her IMDb is like
a
scroll. Sarah Jane, I always prefer the Rani heavy episodes, and this is because she's so good. I mean, everyone's good, but she's absolutely brilliant.
She was and she was great because she wasn't, I think, who we thought would be cast. Because I think in our head, so when I was writing my first one,
So she hadn't been cast when you were writing.
No, when we were writing, right. She was cast by Madwoman in the Attic because that was her second year. But for Mark of the Berserker, she hadn't been cast. And I think in my head, I'd imagined her. I don't know if we talked about it, but almost more of Ace, a bit like Ace. So she would be very small, badges, and all sort of very, always got a notebook in her hand, always be like, oh, okay, you know, and she'd be going, go get her type thing. It means that, like, so for example, there's a bit in Mark of the Berserker where Rani almost bullies Luke into, come on, we've got to go and explore, don't be silly, you know, we've got to find out what's going on with Clive. And I find it slightly odd looking because I'm like, actually, Angela's so tall and beautiful. And at that point, Tommy, you know, is still quite young, he looks a bit younger, and I found it, but it meant that actually what we got to do was see her in action for Gears 2, and she's got a sort of northern sensibility to her, and she's very, very funny, so it meant it was a really great opportunity for me to really push the comedy in Madwoman in the Attic, to push the humour in it, because if you have that humour, you're then devastated when it's all taken away. And I'm so proud of it, but also I just think every actor in it's brilliant. One of the boys, there's two guest boys in it. One of them went on to be in, I think, Wizards of Waverly Place or something. He went on to be a proper American hunk. But yeah, I just think it's beautifully acted by everyone involved. And I'm very proud, you know, not being egotistical, I'm not proud of everything I've done, but that is the thing I think I'm proudest of. I think it's such a beautiful script. I think it's something I've done once. I think everything ties up, everything, it's about all these lonely people. So it's almost a reflection of Doctor Who and as a whole, and the Sarah Jane Adventure specifically. And the thing that I love, and I think it's why I've done quite well in kids' TV, basically has been my career since the Sarah Jane Adventures. I do solid in kids' TV. I haven't done any other since Torchwood. And I think one thing that's a big common theme in kids' TV is finding your own family. It's creating families out of your friends and everything like that. Sarah Jane Adventures, obviously. I think what I do in Madwoman in the Attic is I sort of mirror that. Lots of mirrors. I mirror that. And it's about three, four people, very lonely people. And all they needed to do was talk to each other, and they'd realise, actually, we could be a family. And there's a bit in the spaceship at the end where Brian Miller, Sarah Elizabeth Seyton's husband, say goodbye because he's handed Eve over. Eve is going to go off in space with her boyfriend and the spaceship and everything. And she's like, no, I want you to come with me. And it chokes me up now because the acting is so powerful. And it was also, I'm pretty certain, because I think it came out before the next Doctor
Who.
So I was the first person to have clips from old Doctor Who.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I put it in thinking it would get cut. And I specified where the clips came from because I think it had been, I'd realised, was the baby, the one where Sarah Jane Smith is the baby in it and she goes back in time, one of the Trickster episodes.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was that year and I knew about it or whether that'd been the year before, I can't remember offhand. But I just remember thinking, this is a woman you can literally go see from birth. We've seen her as a kid in flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen her as a teenager in Whatever Happened to Sarah Jane Smith. And then obviously we see her as a 20-something in The Time Warrior. And we see her, right, we see her in The Five Doctors. We see her, in Downtime, which they couldn't get the rights for. Mm-hmm. Specified a clip from Downtime. you know, you can see this woman do all this. And I just thought, where else on television can you see that? Maybe Ken Barlow in Coronation Street, a spaceship that's going to show him his life, is it? And I just thought, what a brilliant opportunity thing that is. And it was a bit of a challenge because that was the first year, I think, it was going up in HD.
Mm-hmm.
And there were rules that if you advertised a TV show as being in HD, a certain percentage of it had to be in HD. So obviously the old TV clips weren't. And they, so they had to keep them just short enough that it was still past that guideline. I just think it's such a powerful moment. And imagine being a kid and watching that. Again, it always ties in when I was doing Sarah Jane Adventures and when I do kids' TV now, it always ties into what was it like watching it as a kid. I've been to that, so the verb voicing, what was it like watching it with your mum? And I thought, imagine being a kid and watching for the first time, a bit like it's sort of wrapping everything up almost together in a neat bow. But when I was about watching The Five Doctors for the first time, seeing these clips from this show that I was in love, and, you know, imagine being a kid watching, you've seen School Reunion, you love Doctor Who, you're watching this show, you know she was in Doctor Who in the past, but how many of them are going to have seen, you know, a clip from the past? And then suddenly they see her meeting the old Doctors and they see her in clips and they see her with aliens and stuff. And I just think, and for me, it was such an important thing because I just thought it would be so exciting to watch as a child.
As has recently been announced, you're actually back with Beyond Bannerman Road with Big Finish. Sadly, obviously, without Sarah Jane, but with Rani centre stage as a journalist, just like Sarah Jane was before her. What's that been like? Have you been on board since the beginning?
It's Matt Fitton and Emily Cook are... One's a producer, one's a script. I never know. They're my bosses on it. Yeah, they came to me and I jumped at the chance because, you know, that was one of the happiest periods of my life. And yeah, I was just very keen to do it. I think the one thing I did push right from the beginning was that the whole ethos of the Sarah Jane Adventures is its life on Earth can be an adventure too. So this shouldn't be just them having sort of Doctor Who style adventures. It should be continuing their lives because that's one thing we did in TV series. They would stop a meteorite hitting the Earth and then they'd have to do their GCSE homework. So yeah, that was just really, really excited to write for the characters and write for that world again. The thing I pushed for was I certainly pointed out that they are would now be 30. If this comes out next year, 2023, the characters would be 30. And that's something Big Finish has never done. That's something you very rarely see done on anything, a 15-year actual age gap for characters. And I thought, I think that's a really interesting thing to explore. Let's not pretend. And I don't think, I think Emily and Matt wanted that from the beginning as well. But yeah, I think we were all agreed we didn't want it to be they're a couple of years older and they're doing whatever. It was like, no, these are the characters who we saw growing up. You know, we saw them go from sort of 13, 14, 15, 16.
Yeah.
And they're now 30, you know, and it's very, my story is very much Rani and Clyde at the age of 30. And it's fun to sort of think about how people do stay the same as well. You know, they're still very much Clyde and Rani from the TV series, you know, because I personally think you don't change that much. Well, lots of your external stuff changes, I think, from 15 to 30. I think you find more of your way in the world, but I think a lot of your internal stuff stays the same, you know, and it's just been really fun to write that.
You've written the pilot episode, so to speak, or the first episode. So was that a lot of, did that have its own challenges? Was that reintroducing these characters?
I think it had the challenge in, I approached it as, nobody is going to buy this and listen to us who doesn't know who Rani and Clyde are. So I don't need to establish them particularly. I just need to establish their new circumstances. And then I think the challenge was that I knew people would... Well, I think there was two big challenges. One is I knew people would want to know what's happening with other characters and stuff like that. So I wanted to put some stuff like that in because I felt you want to know. You want to know what's happened to Clyde's mum, what's happened to his dad. You want, you know, little updates without it being a sit-down exposition thing. But also related to the exposition thing is the reality of how much Clyde and Rani have stayed in touch, because this follows on from Farewell, Sarah Jane Smith. So that establishes that they have very different lives in very different worlds. Now, I am in touch with everybody. I'm in touch with people from school who I haven't seen in nearly 30 years. I'm in touch.
You haven't saved the world with them.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, but we stay in touch on Facebook. So I can actually tell you elements of people's lives that I haven't seen in 30 years. I can tell you how many kids they've got and so on. And we don't even talk that much. We just see each other on social media. So with this, we needed Clyde and Rani to be, have been separated for a little bit. Solar. Clyde has a bit of surprising news, and it's his surprising news won't work if he saw Rani last week. But at the same time, I don't ever believe Clyde and Rani wouldn't be in touch. So that was the challenge. It's all, that's always a challenge of, you know, it's certainly a real thing we wanted in the Sarah Jane Adventures. Russell pushed for it, and I loved it, was that when a character like Maria left the Sarah Jane Adventures, she didn't leave their lives. Because people people when they leave EastEnders disappear and are never mentioned again. And that's just not real.
Just going to Leeds.
Yeah, exactly. And then never mentioned again with this. So it was just the challenge of doing it as the first episode. So therefore, Clyde and Rani, it makes sense for them not to have seen each other for a while, but at the same time, not trying to pretend they haven't spoken to each other in 5 years. So, yeah, hopefully I've got the balance right. But also I just want it to be fun. Capture the fun of the Sarah Jane. Capture the sadness that Sarah Jane's no longer with us. You know, we don't. It's about not ignoring that, but it's about acknowledging the role Sarah Jane has played in their lives and accepting that that is a big part of who they are. But they have to live their lives, their own lives. They have to go on their own paths. And that's that was quite the challenge actually, because I didn't want to ignore Sarah Jane Smith.
No.
But it has to be Rani's story. It's the Rani Chandra adventure. So I think it's, I hope I've got it right. I reread the script the other day, actually, because I thought it was, I just remembered it being quite fun. And I thought, well, I'll give it a read because I'm struggling with the script I am writing. And I thought, actually, yeah, I think it works. I think it's a nice tribute to the Sarah Jane adventures and the character of Sarah Jane Smith, while at the same time establishing this is the world of Rani Chandra.
Anyway, we have talked for long enough, and I've taken up enough of your time, but it's been great talking to you about Doctor Who and related issues, and great to see you just on a personal level.
All right.
See you later. Cheers.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by Jane Steventon of Babylon Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter.